Available now from Graphic Audio.
What is it?
There is something.
I feel it too. A scent in the air. Like death.
You are surprised that I would help to finance Abbot Orland's ascension?
That is the business of the Abelicans. I do not understand why we should choose to get involved.
Our relationship with the Abelicans will prove of utmost importance in the crucial time that will soon be before us. All is in place. I will be reborn, and you will be there to watch over me until we are again united. I know this because I have been reborn time and time again. And after you witness the great transcendence, you will rest easier at night, in full confidence that Yatol is with us every step.
Welcome, Fiend.
I have seen the chi. I have touched chi. I have grasped it. I know it.
I had hoped that you would see it, Paganel. It is good that you have, for now there is a road before you.
I would walk the path of all colors, Master Chaos.
You understand the danger?
To wait is folly, but I am prepared.
Have you determined your road beyond that?
I have seen the steps and the grasses in my dreams, and I know that I must return there.
Don't miss part one of the Demon Wars Saga Book 6, Transcendence. Available now in Graphic Audio.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Vada's War by Elizabeth Moon. Book 4. Command Decision. Part 1. Narrated by Nanette Savard. With performances by Christopher Sheeran, Colleen Delaney, David Coyne, Lily Beacon, Jeff Baker, Michael Glenn, Peter Stray, Andy Clements, Joe Brack, Mort Shelby, Eric Messner, Danny Gavigan, Karen Novak, Jeff Allen, Yasmin Twazon, Michael John Casey, Margie Tompros, Richard Rowan, Thomas Penny, Katie Foster, Tim Getman, Ken Jackson, Terrence Aselford, Casey Platt, Tim Carlin, Tony Nam, and Jonathan Watkins.
Raphael Dunbarger landed at Nexus Center Port as Jensen Ratanvi, a staid, slightly paunchy, middle-aged businessman in food service with a Cascadian identity. His tidy gray beard and gray-streaked hair, his padded cheeks and aged skin, his sober business suit, with a few lines of Cascadian green through its subtle gray plaid, all fit this image. Customs and Immigration passed him through, as his bioassays all matched his identity, as well they should. Short-acting DNA subs programmed with his alter's bioassays might give Rafe a temporary headache, but that was a price he could pay. He had obtained this first false ID at Cascadia more than a decade before, and he'd used it here several times, on visits his family hadn't known about. The trip from Cascadia had been no worse than usual. He had spent the 29 days chatting with other business travelers, exercising in the business class gym, reading in the business class lounge, avoiding the gawking tourists and the family groups as his persona required, and carefully not thinking about Kai or Stella Vada. Kai was beyond his reach, probably dead. He could not tease Stella now, not until she reached some equilibrium with her new identity. Instead, he toyed with ISC's problems.
How did so many Ansibles go bad all at once? Surely not chance. Who did it? Why is repair so slow? If I can restore function in a few hours, why aren't ISC's repair teams making more headway? How deeply have the pirates infiltrated ISC?
Landing on Nexus 2, he carefully did not let himself call it home, Rafe pushed that puzzle aside. Jensen Ratanvi needed to find a way to contact Rafe's family discreetly. First, he headed for the Ambassador, a commercial hotel frequented by business travelers, where he had stayed before. His minimal luggage trailed him on a rented hover pad. Once installed in his room, he first dealt with the hotel's surveillance system and then installed his own unique gear. The hotel's system would now inform the hotel that Jensen Ratanvi came in, bathed, slept, and went out, on a reasonable but not too rigid schedule. It would believe anything he sent it, including remotely from his implant. Pseudo-calls would be noted, pseudo-messages would be sent. Then Rafe called up the business directory on the room display, marking the sorts of businesses he should, in this persona, mark, then tapping the key to collapse the rest of the directory. What he really wanted to know, he had noted in passing. ISC headquarters still had the same public access number. Not that Jensen Ratanvi had any reason to call there. After a mediocre meal at the hotel's cafe, Rafe headed out into the city. It was autumn here, just after midday local time. He drew a deep breath, anticipating and then enjoying the familiar fragrance, childhood deep in his memory. His favorite time of year, with apples ripe on the trees and the autumn mushrooms mingling their scent with that of fallen leaves, even here in the city's commercial district. Probably every world had its characteristic scents, but he spent nearly all his time on ships and stations. He felt a strange mix of nostalgia and fear. This was home, and home could be deadly. The number 161 tram still ran from the Spaceport Hotel District out to the northern suburbs. Rafe rode it to the last stop, seeing little change from the last time he'd been here, except that the long-delayed northern extension of the freight monorail was finally in place. He got off in the bustling little market, now full of schoolchildren buying treats after school, and women, mostly employees, he knew, buying fresh produce and meat for dinner. He headed for Luce's, sat down at an outside table, and ordered a slice of honey cake and tea with lime. The lime came partly pared, a curl of peel holding it to the rim of the glass. He stared at it a moment.
Where is Kai by now? Off on that idiot attempt to build a fleet out of a bunch of untrained privateers? Dead. She must be dead by now. It won't help anything to think about her.
Except that she had shipboard ansibles and intended to use them. That, Rafe had to think about, and carefully, before he told his father. ISC must not decide she was an enemy. He owed her that much, just in case she was still alive. His portable security system informed him that, aside from the general surveillance designed to notice and focus on suspicious activity, he was not observed. Humans were inattentive witnesses anyway, and no one really cared about a middle-aged, slightly paunchy man quietly eating honey cake and drinking tea. Nor would they care if he appeared to be talking to himself, Almost everyone had an implant, and most of those had skull phones. He activated his own skull phone and called his father's private number. His father might be in a meeting, might not answer at once, but it was worth trying.
This number is no longer available. Please check the number you are calling and try again.
Rafe sat very still, then made himself breathe normally. It had been years. The number was in his implant files, but perhaps he had flicked the wrong one. That could happen. He entered it again.
This number is no longer available.
Rafe closed the connection and took a bite of honey cake.
No longer available? Did he change it for some reason?
That could be awkward. Rafe's business persona had no reason and no influence to get access to ISC's chief executive. Surely his father hadn't died. Someone would have told him. His mother would have, he was sure. He activated the table's local information file. His family's home number would not be listed in such a public place, but he remembered a lot of local numbers, and he could see if there had been an overall change. No. He did not have his mother's private skull phone number, nor his sister's, and he had not wanted to call the house. All calls were recorded, and Jensen Ratanvi had no reason to call that number.
Call ISC headquarters? Use it one of my other names? One of the names known to ISC's internal security? Very dangerous if someone there is crooked.
He found a useful number only 2 digits off his home, Flassick's Bakery Supplies, and marked it on the table's list. Then he entered his own home's number. A simple mistake, if anyone asked.
Please state your name and reason for calling.
That was not a voice Rafe knew. None of the household he recognized, though his parents could have hired new servants since his last visit home. But the hair rose on his arms. The link was hardbound, so that he could not simply cut off the call.
This is Jensen Ratanvi, just arrived from Cascadia. I'm trying to reach Flassick's Bakery Supplies. You are a purveyor of custom-designed commercial bakery equipment and specialized mixes, are you not?
You have the wrong number. Where are you calling from?
It had to be official. Something was very wrong indeed.
From a place, Luce's? They have honey cakes and lime tea.
And when did you say you arrived?
A few hours ago. My ship from Cascadia docked at Nexus Station yesterday.
Do not attempt to end this call. Just a moment.
Rafe finished his honey cake and sipped tea while he waited.
You entered the wrong number. A 7 instead of a 5. We have confirmed your arrival today. You may end this call now.
What is this about? Is something wrong?
It is no affair of yours.
Would you like something else?
Luce's proprietor, whom Rafe had known since childhood, stood by the table looking at him with suspicion but no recognition. Rafe waved his hand at the crumbs on his plate.
It is very good, but this is confusing. I need to contact Flassick's Bakery Supplies, and I entered the wrong number, and someone was very rude to me.
Luce picked up the plate.
Well, we aren't as formal as you Cascadians. Don't assume we're rude if we're not all flowery.
Rafe wondered who had told Luce that he was Cascadian.
No offense intended. I was just surprised. Do you know where Flassick's Bakery Supplies is? Perhaps I should walk there instead of trying to call. I don't want to make more mistakes.
I can take you there myself. I was going over to get the estimate on a new oven.
Rafe doubted that, but he was willing to let Luce walk with him the several blocks to Flassick's. Anything to convince the ant's nest he'd kicked that he was harmless and forgettable. On the way, he was able to convince Luce that he knew something about bakeries. Luce didn't seem to realize that it was mostly Luce's own knowledge that Rafe had picked up as a boy, being fed back to him in handy snippets. Once in the store, he invented a problem with oven manufacturers on Cascadia and inquired soberly about the possibility of importing high-volume, precise temperature control ovens from Nexus. He had shipping costs at his fingertips. He ran over the figures with the enthusiasm and thoroughness of any businessman. Luce, he noticed, was still hovering across the room, trying to pretend a serious conversation with another man.
I'm afraid not. It's simply too expensive, even if we went straight to your manufacturers.
Perhaps we can hire some of your experts as consultants instead. I know ovens are supposed to be simple, mature technology, but every time we try to scale up bakery output, we end up with inferior product and unhappy customers. Thank you for your time. You were very helpful, and I'm terribly sorry I can't promise a sale. You will forgive me.
No need to apologize, sir. It's my job. Oh, you're from Cascadia, right?
Yes. I suppose we do seem overly formal to you, but that's not intended as an insult.
Rafe had always enjoyed his Cascadian persona. Overblown courtesy could be every bit as deadly as biting sarcasm, an art form with its lethal edges well concealed rather than exposed.
Not at all. We're a bit too direct sometimes, probably. It was a pleasure, sir.
And to me as well.
Rafe stood up to leave, and was not surprised that Luce was also through, and coming toward him, smiling.
Success?
Alas, not. Transportation is still too high. But don't let me detain you. You have a business to run.
Luce seemed willing enough, once outside, to turn back toward his own place. Rafe went to an information kiosk and looked up the manufacturers whose names he'd just learned, then called each one to inquire about off-world consultancy contracts. Since he could use the same spiel with each one, the rest of his mind was free to wonder how long it would take to bore the man watching him from the cafe across the street, and how soon he could evade his watchers. By now it was late afternoon, time for workers to be coming home. Most people would be thinking of food or entertainment or both, and so might a businessman from off-world. Rafe bustled across the street and interrupted a waiter at the cafe.
Where can a visitor get some, you know...
food, drink, or sex?
Oh, I was thinking dinner and a show. Music, dance, something like that. Anything but my hotel room.
The waiter pointed with his elbow.
The Zadaya Dinner Theater is about 6 blocks that way. Please excuse me, I have customers.
Rafe's watcher was easily close enough to overhear, even if he didn't have a spike mic. Rafe turned away and headed that way, stopping several times to ask passers-by if he was going in the right direction. He'd been to the dinner theater once as a child, when they'd had a special children's holiday program, something with fairies and unicorns and a wicked witch flying through the air. They'd been given all the candy they could eat, and he had been heartily sick on the way home. The next year, he'd refused to go. He hoped dinner would be better this time. On the way, he called his hotel on the skull phone and asked the concierge to arrange a ticket for him. It was waiting when he came to the ticket office. He went in, while his follower had to stop and buy a ticket, and looked around. Tables arranged in steeply pitched rows around the playing space, which looked much smaller now. Emergency exits there and there. Restrooms, male and female. A stairway to the balcony level. The bar to one side, where the early arrivals were gathered at small tables or standing by the polished bar. He headed that way, showed his ticket to the usher, and chose a tiny table in an alcove. 2 hours later, replete with a surprisingly good meal, he was eeling out the emergency exit without tripping its automatic alarm. The business suit and certain other elements of his disguise were stowed in the men's room, behind a ceiling tile over one of the stalls. He wore a camouflage skin suit, and in the soft autumn mist that always came up after dark, he had no trouble passing unseen through the town streets, then along the private road to his family's home. He knew every centimeter of the road, every bush, every tree, every place someone could hide, every surveillance device, and its range and sensitivity. He was prepared to confuse, to fox the scans, to disable some completely if he must. He was not prepared to find the place uninhabited and unprotected, except by its fence and hedge, and one very obvious police guard at the gate. He got in unnoticed, which he expected, and into the house, the empty house, with only a few dim lights on and all surveillance gear disconnected. The furniture was still there, the gleaming tiles of the kitchen, the long, polished floor of the grand salon. Though the leaves of the ornamental tigus drooped, and the soil beneath it was dry. Tall bookcases in the library still held their books, both modern and antique. The music room still held the priceless grand piano, the concert harp, the cabinets full of music scores and recordings. A pale, irregular area, perhaps 1 by 2 meters, marked the floor, visible even in the dim light. He could not resist going upstairs to his old room, telling himself he might find some useful clue on the second floor. He had suspected his parents would clear it, turn it into a guest room, but instead, it seemed unchanged, a wrenching time capsule, a crude model of an Ansible platform. A school project for which he had won an award when he was 9 still stood on a shelf, the faded ribbon beside it. Textbooks still jammed the low bookcase. Even his clothes, including the uniform of the hated boarding school, were still in the closet, carefully sealed in preservative packs. For a moment, he leaned his head on the closet doorframe. He could not have said in that instant if it was rage or pain that wrenched so powerfully. He had been prepared to have his life erased, removed utterly from his respectable family's awareness. But they had kept, someone had kept, so much. Even, and tears burned his eyes, the fateful display sword that had saved his life and caused him so much grief. He eased back downstairs and out of the house with his usual skill, while his emotions swirled. He had not known. He had not understood. What he had not understood, he could not say. He wanted desperately to see his father, talk to him. He forced that aside as he moved back across the property toward the road. Whatever had gone wrong, he must not be suspected or captured now. Re-entering the theater at the climax of the first act, he slipped unobtrusively into the men's room, into the stall he had used, retrieved his costume, and put it on over the skin suit, and then stuck a finger down his throat. It was easier than he'd thought it would be, and his face was suitably pale when he looked in the mirror. He returned to his table at the intermission. A passing waitress stopped, frowning with concern.
I noticed you were gone for a long time, sir. Are you all right?
Too much travel. My stomach, it is delicate, I'm afraid.
Should I call someone?
No, I should be all right now. But tell me, is it possible to get a private car to the port area? I don't know if I feel like riding a tram.
Of course, sir. Would you like me to arrange that now, or do you want to see the rest of the play? It's quite good.
I will try to stay, but...
The waitress gestured at the call button on his table as the house lights began to dim.
Just press this button if you need me.
Thank you.
Through the second act of the musical comedy, he tried to think rather than feel. He had expected a chilly reconciliation or an angry rejection, not this blank nothingness of absence. Surely he would have heard if they were dead. But he had not been at his last reported address. He had been in space, much of the time in FTL flight, utterly unreachable for more than half a standard year now. Perhaps they had died, and no one could find him.
Why then the odd response to my call? And if they aren't dead, where are they?
He clapped with the rest when the show was over, and the waitress came over.
Sir, I called a car for you just a few minutes ago. It will pick you up right out front.
Oh, thank you so much. You're very kind.
He had already left a generous tip.
You're welcome. I hope you feel better.
His watcher was outside on the steps, feigning interest in a poster advertising the show. Rafe leaned on one of the pillars until a car drew up.
Are you Sir Kenson Ratnavy?
The watcher stared fixedly at the poster. Better than whirling around... but not much. Rafe got into the car and gave the hotel name and address to the driver. He made no effort to lower his voice, and besides, the watcher could always check with the car hire company. The paunchy foreigner had indeed gone straight back to his hotel after being sick in the men's room. Rafe lay a long time on the bed, wondering what to do next. The news feed in his room, its sound automatically muted this late at night, had nothing about his family. and only the blandest announcement that ISC was making good progress restoring Ansible service. The talking head for that announcement was Lou Parmina, his father's closest associate and expected successor. Rafe remembered the man, intelligent, sophisticated, affable, who had been his father's messenger in the most difficult years when his father had virtually disowned him. Parmina had counseled patience, had promised to do what he could to mend the breach. He had sent friendly notes now and then with the remittance payments. He looked much the same, with the well-groomed gloss of the successful man of business. Rafe turned off the newsfeed. He didn't care about Parmina unless the man had something to do with his family's disappearance, which surely he did not.
He is well up the ladder to the highest position in the most powerful monopoly in human space. What more could he want? Where is my father? My mother? My family?
Rafe felt as if a crevasse had opened up beside him and half his universe had disappeared into it, as if he teetered on the brink of some bottomless pit. He shivered and dragged the bedcovers over himself. It was like something Kai had said, tried to say, about her family's death. He had been so sure he knew how she felt, what it was she had to cope with.
An adult, someone who'd been out on her own. How bad could it be?
He had known nothing. As the shiver built into shudders, as he felt himself engulfed in a sorrow colder than death itself, he knew that she had felt this. The last of her family, as he might well be the last of his. Bereft, alone, and so much younger than he was, so much less experienced. And she had gone on. He let himself hold to that for the moment. That crazy idiot, that stiffly, stubbornly upright prig of a girl who shared with him a guilty, secret delight in killing. She had not collapsed under this sorrow. She had fought back. She had saved him, humiliating as that was, and Stella and Toby and her ship and her crew, and gone on being who she was. He was warm again and able to breathe. She was probably dead by now, or soon would be, and because of that, it was safe to admit what he felt. To himself, anyway.
And what would she do in this situation?
He almost chuckled, imagining that dark, vivid face, those intense eyes. What he himself would do, would find a way to do, when he'd had some rest. What a team they could make, if they didn't kill each other, if they didn't each die before they met again. And on that thought, he fell asleep. The smell woke him. A chemical knife. It stabbed deep into his awareness. He was sitting bolt upright before he realized he was awake. That miserable implant. Kai. It must be Kai trying to use the cranial implant. He staggered into the bathroom, the only logical excuse for waking so suddenly if someone had breached his security. Only the alarm functioned without an external power source. He did not want to link himself into the room's power outlets, and yet he came out of the bathroom, checked his security devices, and burrowed into his luggage for the special cables. He had checked the quality of the line signal and was about to hook himself up when he had another thought.
What if it isn't Kai?
Here, of all places, someone knew that he had a cranial Ansible. His father knew. The technicians who had built and installed it knew. They were supposed to have been told that it had failed, that it was both useless and dangerous, and all their notes and so on were supposed to have been destroyed.
But what if not?
What if whatever happened to his family had let the enemies know not only that he had a cranial Ansible, but also how to contact him? He would be immobilized, nearly helpless, as long as he was hooked in.
But if I don't hook in?
The hotel room had not been designed to be impenetrable, but he did the best he could, as silently as possible, with the chair and the ottoman. Then he arranged the cables, took a deep breath, and activated the Ansible. It was not quite like using an ordinary skull phone. Ordinary skull phones didn't smell like gas leaks, skunks, rancid butter, wet dog. The smell associated with being called changed to the one associated with a connection being made. Then a faint sound he associated with an open line, nothing more. Somewhere, someone's telltales should have gone from standby to connected. Someone had placed the call. Someone should be speaking. Rafe said nothing. Ansible to Ansible was not the same as implant to implant. He could not strip data from someone's implant this way, even if they had the same setup he did, which he hoped no one but Kai Vada did. His only safety lay in patience, waiting out whomever had called. Seconds passed. Minutes. A trickle of sweat ran down his back. If it had been someone friendly on the other end, they'd have spoken by now. Kai, certainly. His father, if nothing was wrong with him.
Anyone else? Trying to trace the signal? Planning to send some devastating blast right into my brain?
At least Rafe knew, hoped he knew, that wouldn't work. The safety interlocks prevented any excessive power surges. Nor should they have been able to trace his location from the Ansible's response. But no one who wouldn't speak to him should have been able to initiate the call. Finally, he heard, dimly, voices talking. Not talking to him, but talking somewhere in the pickup range of whatever unit they were using. He boosted the sensitivity, shunting the input to storage for later analysis.
The light's green. It has to be connected.
It's not in the index. A private Ansible? Would he have had a private off-list Ansible?
No, it's supposed to be the sun's private number. Nobody's there. It's connected.
Could be in automatic mode. If it's designed for relays or something.
Three voices, Rafe decided. Too far from the pickup to tell much about them, at least without signal analysis.
Hey! Answer me!
Rafe said nothing.
Gotta be on auto. I don't hear a thing.
So he lied to us. Not his son's number.
Or his son has it on auto, but with no pickup message.
We should leave him a message.
Not until we know where he is.
Rafe sat a long moment without moving before he unplugged the cable and recoiled it into its place in his bag. Two and two in this case made a very unsavory four. The most likely he to have told them the number was his father. He would not have given that number except at great need, probably under duress. That, and the trap on the house number, the immediate tail put on what should have passed as an innocent businessman, the empty house, all that suggested an organization with enormous resources, if not the government itself, operating with the government's consent, if not approval. Remembering what Kai and Stella had told him about the attacks on Vata on Slaughter Key, he wondered if the pirates had somehow intimidated the Nexus government into letting them kidnap the head of ISC, or if they had infiltrated some group within ISC. Not likely, he decided. The men had not sounded like expert ISC communications technicians. They'd used none of the jargon peculiar to the trade. That meant they might not be able to trace the Ansible relay beyond Nexus, and thus could not find him. On the other hand, they might have a skilled technician in their organization, or even captive. Either way, Jensen Ratanvi and his food processing needed to disappear in a way that would not alert anyone to anything. He would have to leave the planet, or appear to, on his way back to Cascadia. It was almost dawn. An energetic businessman with a digestive upset might well be up and making calls, hoping to find a place on a ship home. Then again, he'd been here only a day. He wouldn't be likely to give up so easily. Nexus had other cities, other suppliers. Surely the man would travel around, unhappy stomach and all. Rafe logged on to the hotel's travel information site and soon had an itinerary that gave him a reason to be in every major city over the next 4 weeks. He declined the hotel's booking agency and made the reservations himself, choosing to change carriers here and there. With excellent communications links, Nexus travelers were spontaneous in their schedules. No one would notice particularly if someone on a scheduled ferry or flight didn't show up, especially if the passenger called in. By the time Rafe came down to breakfast in his business persona, he had determined that the contact attempt had originated here, on Nexus. His illicit, and, he hoped, undetectable probes of the Nexus Ansible had gotten him that far. The origination code for the call was not his father's, and he didn't recognize it. He would have to hack into the main database to find a name, and it might not be the right one. The call had relayed through a communications satellite, then covering an area 2 time zones away. Beyond that, he had been able to find one relay, a surface installation near a town named, with no originality at all, Pittville, presumably for the nearby pit mine. He ate a moderate breakfast, explaining to his waiter that something he'd eaten the day before had disagreed with him. After checking out, Rafe went directly to the regional airport. Someone, he was sure, would be checking on Jensen Ratanvi's movements. Let them. Jensen would be boringly predictable for a day or so at least. While waiting for his flight, he used the data boards, as any other business traveler might do. All bore the ISC logo, and, here on ISC's home planet, came with ads extolling ISC's technological and marketing genius. Rafe spent a moment downloading the public information to his implant, then went on searching for food processing specialists' current contact numbers at his next stop, and began calling them as he thought about the ISC listing.
Interesting.
His father was listed as an ex officio member of the board, and Lou Parmina was now listed as CEO. Not surprising that he was the new CEO if something had happened to Rafe's father, but that didn't explain the empty house, the traps on communications, that call on his cranial ansible.
Cousin Stella!
Toby's voice and the skitter of his dog's claws on the floor brought Stella Vada out of another dismal reverie. She glanced at the security escort, annoyed with herself for having missed the warning tone of the entry, and nodded to him. He nodded back and sketched a salute before leaving the apartment. She checked to make sure the exit warning came on. Then she forced a smile and turned to greet Toby.
Yes, Toby?
They moved me up another class. The test results are in, and can I have a snack?
Stella waved a hand toward the kitchen.
Of course. Go right ahead. But then I want you to clean up this mess.
Spread across the apartment's living room were boxes of what Stella dismissed as tech stuff. Whatever didn't fit in Toby's own small room. Stella had quit looking in there. The visual chaos gave her a headache.
It's not just a mess. It's all organized. Ouch!
He had stepped on something. Stella hoped it was as sharp as the little knob with a sharp prong that she had stepped on earlier.
I'm tired of walking on it. At least stack it all by the wall, can't you?
It takes longer to find things.
Stella looked at him. If he had ever been impressed by her beauty, a weapon she'd wielded skillfully since childhood, he was over it now. And she recognized the tone as one she herself had used on her parents. But Toby was more malleable than she had been. After a moment, he flushed.
I'm sorry, Cousin Stella.
And, the other half of the sandwich in his mouth, he began moving the boxes. In the several 10 days since Kai had gone off on her insane quest, as Stella thought of it, and Rafe had left for Nexus, she had had more than enough time to examine her life in light of the revelation about her parentage. Her real parentage. Biometric data proved she was Osman Vada's daughter, some stranger mother's daughter, not the daughter of Stavros and Helen Stamarkos Vada, as she'd always believed. Her blonde hair, her violet eyes, her beauty came not from the Stamarkos family, but from someone else. Someone she'd never known, probably would never know. Kai had said it didn't make any difference, but she knew better. She had tried to shake off the waves of anger, grief, and depression that washed over her several times a day. But except for Toby, she was alone, absolutely alone, as she had never been before. She had a hard time concentrating on trade, on finding cargo for the ship that had been Furman's, when she felt so empty. She had forced herself to do the obvious things, hire security for herself and Toby and the Vada dock space, talk to Captain Orem of Gary Tobai about what security clearances new crew should have, but it was so hard to focus on all that. If only she'd had one other adult Vada to talk to. Aunt Grace, for instance.
You know, I really think I can make another one.
Another one what?
Ansible. Like the one Captain Cousin Kai left with you. Small enough to fit on a ship, I mean.
That's... Stella started to say impossible, then stopped. Toby had already modified the appliances that had come with the apartment, giving them more sophisticated control systems, and upgraded the apartment's security system. She remembered Quincy and Rafe both mentioning the boy's knack for technical subjects and tasks. An idea tickled her, the first positive one she'd had in a long time.
If you could make another one, a few of them, we could put them on Vada ships.
Toby stopped where he was, a box of components in either hand.
That's what I thought. If you could get reports from our ships right away, even in systems where the Ansibles didn't work, that would give us an edge.
Stella could not imagine anyone cobbling together something that intricate in an apartment bedroom.
Do you really think you can? Don't you need a special lab or something?
Not really. I'd love to have a lab of my own, but it's mature tech, really. It's not as finicky as it used to be.
That sounded like a quote from Quincy.
I'm really close now. Just another few days, I think. There's this part I don't understand. It seems like a backwards way of designing it. But there has to be a reason.
What made you think of copying one? Where did you learn?
We need them. Captain... Cousin Kai could use more. Every ship, really, could use one. Except it's not our design, so we can't sell it. Anyway, Rafe talked to me a lot, you know. He's nice, even if he did scare me at first.
Stella blinked at the notion of Rafe, with his many aliases and his unquestionably shady past, being labeled nice by anyone.
I kept asking him when he was fixing those broken Ansibles, and finally, he said he'd explain it, if I promised not to tell anyone else about the Ansible repair stuff he taught me, because it was an ISC secret. I understood some of it on my own. I always thought it must be like FTL drives, but it's not, really. Well, sort of. In the basic theory of end dimensions, but not in the practical application. Or space travel would be instantaneous, too.
Toby seemed to stare into the distance, and then shook his head.
No, I haven't figured that part out yet.
Stella's head whirled. Her own abilities, assuming she had any, lay very far from the things Toby talked about.
No rush. You can stick to Ansibles for a while, can't you?
Oh, sure. I just need to figure out why there's a lockout circuit. What's it protecting the rest of it from?
Or what it's protecting.
I hadn't thought of it that way. I thought it must be something to protect the Ansible, but that's not necessarily... Well, thanks, Cousin Stella.
Toby wandered off to his room, followed by Rascal, without picking up any more of the mess. Stella went back to her work. Standard Vada trade routes made interconnecting rings rather than emanating from a few hubs. A Vada ship from the Orleans-Vishwa-Darien-Moscow route should arrive in system in the next few days. Ordinarily, Katrine Lamont's captain, now Balthazar Oram, transferred from Gary Tobai because Stella knew him better, would have offloaded cargo consigned here, sequestered cargo that would be transferred directly to the incoming ship, acquired more cargo to take on from here, and left room for any cargo the incoming ship needed to transfer. But now, with trade down and Vada's reputation almost as ruined as its headquarters and coffers, nothing was that simple. Still, there was always someone who wanted to ship something somewhere. Stella had put off hiring new crew for Gary Tobai, and Katrine Lamont was still undercrewed, but at least the ship was in perfect shape. Stella had sold off all the cargo that wasn't consigned elsewhere. About 30% was, and of that, a little less than half would need to be shifted to Marcus Celine, the ship due in. The sale of cargo, plus the company's share of profits from Toby's dog breeding fees, had kept her balance on the right side of the ledger. And in another 35 days, she would have access to the late Captain Furman's accounts. And if Toby could actually build shipboard Ansibles, maybe it was Osman's genes and not Stavros's that presented her with an inkling of how profitable that could be. But maybe that didn't matter. In her imagination, a new corporation rose from the ashes of the old. Vada once more, trade and profit. For the first time, it seemed real. Herself in a proper office giving orders. In the meantime, her business office was the dining room table in the apartment.
Toby burst out of his room a few days later, Rascal scampering around him in frantic circles.
A cousin Stella! I found it!
Stella had just been running the figures again. Marcus Celine had arrived in system and was making its way in from the jump point. She might afford a real office within the next week.
What, Toby?
That thing I told you about! Not the Ansible, or not this Ansible. It's what keeps these from interfacing with the system Ansibles!
Toby grinned, eyes sparkling. For an instant, Stella saw a ghost of the depressed, scared boy she had found in protective custody at Allray. Whatever else she had done wrong in her life, however vicious her biological father had been, she had changed Toby's life for the better. Then her brain caught up with his words.
You mean they could interface?
Yes! It's quite simple, really. Rafe said that they couldn't. They were built so that they couldn't. But he didn't tell me what they'd done. Maybe he didn't know. He said he didn't understand it at all. Anyway, it's this circuit here.
He pushed a printout of a circuit diagram at her. To Stella, it was all lines and symbols, as meaningless as straws in the wind.
If I leave that part out and change this bit here, then it could.
Oh, that would be very useful indeed.
Stella's mind filled instantly with the possibilities for profit. A lot of profit. But surely ISC had all the relevant patents. How could they come up with something on their own, something ISC couldn't interfere with, using Toby's ideas?
Brilliant, Toby. And do you think you can build a working model?
I could do it faster if I didn't have to go to school.
Not that, my boy. You're going to school, and that's final. Besides, you've been enjoying the company. You said so.
Well, yes. Some of the other kids are all right, especially since they moved me up a level. But I want to get this done. It would help us so much. And if ships went out with these, they could relay information from systems where the Ansibles aren't working, until ISC had time to fix them.
I can see that. But you have to go to school anyway. You can work on this in your spare time.
Oh, can I bring some friends over to help me? Some of them are really smart.
No!
It came out harsher than Stella intended, and his expression changed.
Toby, right now this has to be a secret. You know the original technology belonged to ISC. We have to be sure it's legal for us to do this, or...
It can't be illegal to build one for ourselves if we don't sell it.
Yes, it could be illegal. I have to find that out, and in the meantime, don't talk about it. Not to your friends, not to your teachers.
But I don't see why. If it's just for us, why would they care?
Profit. If they own the rights and we make one instead of buying theirs...
But they're not selling them. It's not costing them anything because they're not selling them.
Just let me talk to someone who knows more about the law than either of us before you talk to anyone else.
Toby frowned, but finally nodded.
And Toby, thanks for all your work. If you've really solved that problem, ISC may be paying us. In any event, you're a real contributor to Vada's recovery.
A recovery that she now believed could happen, with or without the input of the Slaughter Key Vadas. Thirteen days later, Stella looked around Vada Transport's new offices, redecorated in Vada colors and fully furnished. Crown and Spears had been willing to advance the money on the expectation of her receiving Furman's accounts within 15 days and the arrival of Marcus Celine. The offices were in an unfashionable quarter of Cascadia Station, toward the tip of one branch, but the rent per square meter was only 65% of that near the trunk. Besides, their business was shipping, and Dockside was across the way. She turned to the receptionist she'd hired for the front office.
This is where you'll be. We're just moving in. It's a little rough, but I assure you the security measures are first rate.
It looks lovely.
The girl, young woman, Stella reminded herself, was Jillian Aston, native of Cascadia, just out of business school, up on the station for the first time. She looked too young, but her manner was brisk, and she seemed to have confidence.
I look forward to serving you. I'm sorry, but I don't know what terms of address are correct for someone from Slaughter Key.
I'm living here now. Whatever's appropriate here. Sarah, isn't it?
Yes, Sierra Vada. Oh, this is so exciting. Mom and Dad never thought I'd get a job off-planet. They kidded me when I signed with the agency.
Well, here's your desk. Let me know if there's anything else you need. I'll be in back. I've got a ship on approach, and I need to talk with the captain.
Thank you, Sierra.
Stella paused in the door to see how Jillian handled the call. Jillian slipped the earbud in.
Good morning, Vada Transport Limited. How may I help you?
Stella slipped through into her own office. Her father's office had been huge in comparison, furnished with antiques and artwork. Hers barely had room for a simple desk, a chair for a visitor, a credenza holding her comm unit, cube reader, and, hidden inside, some supplies. The other door led to a narrow corridor, off which were the supply room and the toilets. Across that, a larger room, where Toby could work. It had been the workshop of the small electronics repair firm and still had workbenches and shelving.
Siravada, General Sales' local supervisor, Sir Sagara, would like to speak with you regarding the cargo coming in on Marcus Celine. May I tell him you will take his call?
Yes. Thank you, Jillian.
Stella's stomach tightened. Now it began. Silly of her. It had begun long before. But now, in a real office, she felt a difference.
Sir Sagara, how may I help you?
They exchanged the elaborate courtesies Cascadian custom dictated, and Stella assured him that the ship on its way did indeed carry cargo consigned to General Sales. She gave him the invoice numbers as well.
And our next departure will be 3 days after Marcus Celine arrives. The route is up on our site, if you have outbound cargo.
You'll keep the same schedule? I am sorry, Saravada. That sounds as if I don't trust you, and I intended no insult.
No offense taken. I quite understand. But yes, I do intend to keep the same schedule, and in fact expand it as other Vada ships come in. Cascadia has ample resources of trained ship crews. It will make a fine hub.
I see. Yes, I believe we'll have cargo ready for shipping by then. I'll get back to you shortly. Thank you for your service, Sarah.
Thank you for your custom, Sir Sagara.
That had gone well. Stella let out a breath, then went back to the front office.
Jillian, we're going to have an order for outgoing cargo. I may not be here when it comes in. Please route it to my desk comp, sorted by destination.
Yes, Siravada. I was just thinking, do you want me to contact the other recipients of inbound cargo that their shipments are on board?
Good idea. I'll send that file to your desk comp with the invoice numbers. Don't tell them the cargo contents, though, just the numbers. And let them know that the departure schedule and route are up on our site for their convenience. Maybe we'll get some more orders.
By the time Toby arrived that afternoon with a float pallet of his supplies, Vada Transport had contracts pending with 5 different shippers for Katrine Lamont's departure. Stella called Captain Oram.
We have shippers. Do you think we should put up the available cubage on our site?
Absolutely. The Captain's Guild will display it for us, as well as the shipping combine. I can do that for you with an automatic update as new cargo comes in. I haven't thanked you, really, for the chance you've given me. You know, after I lost my own ship, I never thought I'd have a command again. And here I am on one of Vada's top ships. Better than anything I ever had before.
Please, don't. I needed a captain, you needed a ship. It worked for both of us. I'm sure you can handle the cat and the trade responsibilities.
I had to say it. But for the moment, trade and profit.
Trade and profit.
The thumps and bangs she'd heard earlier as Toby'd settled his things onto the shelves had stopped. She went to look.
I brought it here, Cousin Stella, under all the other boxes so no one would see it.
In one corner, the plain gray box that Kai had given her, the portable Ansible. Next to it, something roughly the same size and shape, but without the gray skin.
That's the...
Yeah, what I'm working on. Not finished yet, though. It's still gonna draw a fair bit of power. Can we afford it?
Yes.
Stella hoped a fair bit of power would fit into the budget. They had to try. This project was too important to fail because of a few credits.
Can I sleep here? It saved time going back and forth, and I wouldn't need a security escort as many hours.
There's no food here, and I want you in bed at a decent hour. For school. Don't worry about the escort charges.
Excuse me, Sira, but there's an urgent message for you.
Jillian's gaze slid past Stella to linger on Toby. That could be a complication.
From whom?
Oh, sorry, Sira. From Crown and Spears.
Your account has been credited with the sums formerly credited to the late Captain Furman. Would you prefer to have these funds in hand or pay off the advance at this time? Crown & Spears has no problem with continuing the advance on the same terms.
Exorbitant terms to Stella.
I think not. It was an unsecured loan before. Now I could secure it if I chose.
Well, I'm sure something could be arranged for a valued customer such as Vada Transport.
After the first few hectic weeks, as she dealt with Marcus Celine's arrival, the departure of Katrine Lamont, the departure of Marcus Celine, customer inquiries, the sale of unconsigned cargo, and all the other minutiae of running a transport and trade company, Stella realized she had not thought about her own parentage or Kai's adventures for days. Whether Kai was alive or not, she herself was finding her identity as Vata CEO more comfortable with every passing day. Vata ships carried full loads of cargo, even Gary Tobai, for which she'd won a contract to carry cargo between Moscow Confederation orbital stations. Vata's customers stopped by the office to chat and inquire when she would have more frequent departures. Another Vata ship had reported in via Ansible. Its captain accepted her authority. Income still lagged behind expenses, not counting the contributions of Toby's dog Rascal, whose breeding fees kept them solvent, but it trended upward. She had found an intellectual property lawyer who agreed to take up a patent search to see how much of the portable Ansible technology was already controlled by ISC. Toby's school had called once to congratulate her on his behavior.
We usually have much more trouble with students not from our own system. He is an exceptionally polite boy, and we are delighted that you chose to have him attend classes instead of home tutoring.
And his marks in the first reporting period had been superb. Startling, amusing even, that her family identity as that idiot Stella had concealed such abilities, even from her. Nobody here knew about the gardener's son or the family codes. Nobody here knew that Joe was, had been, the brains of the family, and her brothers had been brilliant in their way, while she was only a pretty face, that idiot Stella. Nobody here seemed to care about her parentage, though as the result of a court case, it was in the public records. All that mattered to the Cascadians was her demeanor and her competence. Courtesy had always come easily for her. She found their social rules easy to follow. She'd never fully believed in that competence, but now she saw the proof of it every day, in the respect others gave her, in the contracts and the income.
Trade and profit indeed.
She wished she could tell Aunt Grace, but the slaughter key Ansible remained stubbornly out of order, like so many others. Someday, Vata ships would carry Vata Ansibles, and she could send one back to Slaughter Key. She surprised herself again by thinking of the name, and not home.
Siravada?
Yes?
Stella pushed all other thoughts aside. Business first, reveries later. Or never. She felt ready for whatever came through the door. Once, a routine transition into FTL space had meant safety to Kai Vata. That mysterious and undefined continuum in which the ship now existed had meant time to think, time to plan, time to interact with her crew in an untouchable capsule. She could not be interrupted from outside. She did not have to cope with outside. What she'd known of earlier civilizations, pre-space and early expansion, and their obsession with the vastness of space, the smallness of planets, had always amused her. She had grown up in a spacefaring civilization, embedded in a family whose fortunes came from traveling the spaceways. She had been in deep space herself at 13. Space was no bigger than the ship you were in. So many days in FTL from here to there, so many days or weeks from a jump point to a station. The rest of it didn't matter, really. Now, for the first time, she felt it. That old awe at the size of the universe. Not days from system to system, but years of light burrowing through endless darkness. Though the ship's systems held the temperature at a steady setting, varying it slightly, intentionally, as the shifts changed, she herself felt cold, chilled by unwelcome knowledge. Out there somewhere, beyond her knowledge as beyond her reach, were the pirates, the more than pirates now, who wanted to destroy all the comfortable assumptions of her life and the lives of everyone she'd known, the lives of billions of men and women and children who went to work, ate meals, went to school, played games, made plans based on the certainty that tomorrow would be like today. She felt glued to the certainty, this unwelcome certainty, that they were wrong, pinned to that knowledge of imminent disruption, unable to think or move. She knew, she told herself repeatedly, that this FTL flight gave her respite in which to think, in which to prove that the bold boast she'd made a few days before came from some hidden core of ability, of moral strength. Her crew kept looking at her, giving her little grins and nods. But for now, she was paralyzed, mentally and almost physically, going through the motions of being the bold, brave captain she knew they needed. She had come on the bridge, as usual, to take the first shift report, and now she frowned at the data scrolling past on the screen, as if she could do more than stare at the words and numbers.
What does it all mean, anyway? This ship, the two others, even the pirates and their hordes, are just grains of dust in a vast universe that doesn't care.
She glanced up as someone moved suddenly and saw Lee, her senior pilot, turn to Hugh Pratang, her executive officer.
Please, I have to go now?
Hugh was facing away from Lee, entering something in the log. Kai glanced at Lee, whose face was a strange shade of gray-green.
What's the problem?
Hugh looked over, stiffened, and then caught sight of Kai.
Captain, Mr. Quidlin, what's wrong?
He's sick!
Kai realized how unnecessary that was. She pulled a towel out of the dispenser by the hatch and stepped forward.
Lee, can you talk?
Lee shook his head. The sour stench almost turned Kai's stomach. Hugh took the towel from her and bent down. Her weapons officer, Theo Dannon, gestured feebly.
I feel sick, too.
Leave the bridge.
It was probably just the smell, Kai thought. But Dannon also had an unhealthy greenish look around the mouth. She bent down to look more closely at Lee. His eyes were closed, and his breathing was harsh.
We've been isolated on this ship for too long for it to be any communicable illness. It's gotta be food poisoning or something.
She felt a stab of guilt. She hadn't inspected the galley the day before.
I feel really bad.
Help me get him to a med box.
Kai realized she didn't know if med boxes dealt with food poisoning. She felt stupid suddenly. She was planning to fight a war, and she hadn't hired any medical personnel. It would take more than med boxes. She remembered the vast medical bay on the Mackenzie ship that had treated her. Her mind seemed to wake suddenly from the days of the past shifts. Later, she could think how to increase their medical capacity. Hugh looked around the bridge.
I can do that. One of us needs to be here.
Kai nodded. In FTL flight, nothing ever happened, but still, a senior officer should be on the bridge. Especially if this was more than some random virus.
And I'll send one of the techs up to clean up, in case it's infectious. Don't get contaminated, Captain.
Kai nodded as Hugh hauled Lee up and got a shoulder under his arm. Lee was just able to shamble along as Hugh moved aft. Kai turned up the bridge ventilation and queried the food storage units. All the readouts were in range, coolers and freezers all at the correct temperature. She had come through the galley already without formally inspecting it. It had looked clean and tidy as usual. Surely no one had cooked for the others without washing hands. Everyone had that much sense. In minutes, one of the environmental techs, not Twig, but Bannon, showed up in protective gear with a wet vac.
There's another two sick, Captain. That's four so far. We don't know what it is yet, but we'll run it through the analyzers and see.
Four down within a half hour. Not just some isolated bug Lee'd been harboring since their last time on a station. Possibilities sprang up like weeds. Something they'd missed when clearing the ship of Osman's traps. Something planted by the agent who'd joined the ship as a cargo handler and then died. Sabotage by someone now in the crew.
Anything odd in the environmental cultures?
No, ma'am. At least all the readouts are nominal, though we'll run a check of them. And we're not consuming anything ship-made, anyway.
Kai had known that. She'd spent the money to purchase high-quality rations, and they still had some of Osman's left as well. Osman's.
Take samples of all the surfaces in the galley. Any opened ration containers, everything in the cooler.
Yes, Captain. Mr. Pratang told us that. Mr. Gulandar has people on it, and Mr. Pratang is asking everyone what they ate or drank in the last 2 days.
Bannon finished sucking up the mess, then sprayed with cleanser and vacuumed again, finally applying a decontaminating spray.
Just let that dry, Captain. It'll stay 12 hours and more, and then we'll come give it another spray and vacuum. After that, it'll be safe for normal cleaning.
Thanks. You will let me know what it is.
Of course, ma'am. As soon as we know.
Four so far. If it's something in the food, is it something in Osman's food supply? In what I bought? And is it intentional or accidental? Why aren't we all sick?
They were all eating out of the same food supply. They rotated cooking duties, but... She called up the roster for galley work. If it was unclean pots or dishes, she would have someone's guts for garters. Within a few hours, as Kai paced the bridge deck and thought of more and more items to test, from shampoo to cough lozenges, another five had come down with whatever it was. Vomiting, abdominal pain, diarrhea, weakness that might be from the symptoms or from the cause. The cooking utensils and dishes showed nothing. There was nothing harmful in the water supply.
Nothing shows up on the chem scan. It's not any contact or residual poison in our database. It's got to be contaminated food. If it were the water, everyone would be down with it.
Kai went herself when Hugh took over the bridge again to inspect the latrines, the showers, the galley, the cutlery and dishes. She remembered that she had brought aboard dishes touched, if only briefly, by someone who wanted to send a coded message, a microdot, to someone on her ship. Both men had died. She had to wonder if they had also left a persistent toxin on the dishes. She and her crew had eaten dozens of meals off those dishes since, with no harmful effects, and the dishes had been washed repeatedly. Kai couldn't understand the timing. 9 sick. But as hours passed and no one else came down with the mysterious disease, Kai concentrated on finding out what those 9 had eaten or drunk that no one else had consumed. She had no qualified epidemiologist in the crew, not even a medic. But the environmental department, none of whom had gotten sick, dug through the trash that hadn't yet gone to the recycler, testing everything. Meanwhile, Hugh and Gordon went through the crew list asking questions. Who ate what at which meal, between meals, who had seen someone else eating, and so on. Even though no more crew came down with the mysterious illness, Kai pressed them to keep asking, keep searching for a cause. Finally, Lee came out of a med box, able to answer questions. Kai went down immediately to find out what he knew.
We had a little celebration the other night, nothing big, just a box of sweet snacks from stores and some...
What?
I'm trying to remember. There was this jar somebody had in his personals. Stuff his grandmother made, he said. It had gotten knocked around somehow and leaked a bit, so he offered it to the party. He didn't want to let it sit around unsealed in case it spoiled. You don't suppose that could have been what did it? I mean, how could it spoil in just a few days?
What was it? Animal, vegetable, mineral, liquid, solid?
I don't really know. I guess it did sort of have a kind of... Well, it smelled a bit alcoholic, but it also had a strong smell of fruit. And then some kind of a fishy smell, too. But it was really good spread on those crackers. Can't believe that's what made us sick, though. He said they stored it in crocks back home.
Kai suppressed an urge to shake the information out of him.
Who?
Jemison, starboard aft battery.
Jemison was still in a med box. The readout said he would be out in another 4 hours.
Not everyone in starboard aft is sick. Who else was at this party? Did everybody eat some?
The party, it turned out, had involved much of the crew, who dropped in and out as they had time. Lee wasn't sure who had been there, or not, before he came and after he left. Jemison's contribution was only that single small jar of the stuff, whatever it had been, and only a few of the crew had had a chance at it. Unfortunately, the jar and any remnants of its contents had gone into the recycler, and Environmental had no way to tell which of the stomach contents vacuumed up were responsible.
The only bacterial and viral signatures we have on file relate to our own cultures. I'm sorry, Captain.
Well, not your fault. We need to get a medical database that goes beyond the med boxes.
Whatever its cause, and despite the guilt she felt over having insufficient medical resources aboard, her earlier lassitude had vanished. She put those needs on her list for the next station. No matter how much it cost to maintain a medical team, they needed one, and she'd have to fund it somehow.
Vada's War, Command Decision, is continued on the next CD.